Author's note. Yep, Ellie got COVID. She was dreadfully sick. Recovered and rolled up her sleeves again. I did end up in a role with UN Women, though the 64th annual session of the UN Commission on the Status of Women in New York City was canceled due to COVID-19. Instead, it convened for a procedural meeting on March 9, 2020. Speaking of what really happened versus what didn't, let's get the most pressing question out of the way. How much of this story is true? TLDR answer, most of it, either specifically or generally. While remastering the 1919 unpublished manuscript of my great-great-grandfather George Francis Ellis, I was struck by a couple of things. First, his remarkable feats and near-mythic adventures, surviving against mind-boggling odds, moving through a world teeming with risk, opportunity, and reinvention. He really was on a train with General Custer. He really saw Buffalo Bill on the frontier. And in 1896, he really went to Alaska on business for the North American Transportation and Trading Company before the gold rush frenzy had fully ignited. He was ahead of his time, securing claims number 12 and 13 on El Dorado Creek, which, for a period, yielded $10,000 every 24 hours, making him an immense fortune. Before he lost it in spectacular fashion, as these Old West legends often go, Joaquin Miller, in his Letters from Alaska, dubbed him the Monte Cristo of the Klondike. Second, I noticed the paucity of women in his account. His story is thrilling, but it is also a white man's story recorded in a white man's world. The women and indigenous people he encountered are mere footnotes in his manuscript, mentioned in passing and quickly discarded. His own wife, my pioneering great-great-grandmother Mary Rogers Ellis, aka Teddy, is not even named, though known through other sources. This is how women's and other non-white male histories have been sublimated. But history, real history, is not so singular. Using the breadcrumbs George left behind, I tracked down these forgotten figures and their extraordinary, turbulent lives. Some women did disguise themselves as men to work claims in the gold mines. Cities did pass laws banning people from dressing outside their gender. In San Francisco, an 1863 ordinance made it illegal to appear in public in a dress not belonging to his or her sex. Teddy lived within these shifting constraints, leveraging them, outmaneuvering them, defying them when necessary. Madam Bowers, the San Francisco fortune teller? Real. As is Ellie's reading at the Palmer House in Chicago, reflecting my own. Madam Bowers's prediction in this novel is word for word from my great-great-grandfather's papers. The difference in real life? George heeded her warning. He skipped the voyage she predicted would lead to his death. That ship vanished at sea, and all aboard were lost. The Chicago counterfeiter, Mrs. Joubert, P.B. Weir, Elizabeth Ashe, Alice Griffith, Lily Hitchcock Coit, all real. Elizabeth Ashe and Alice Griffith, born 1869 and 1868 respectively, founded San Francisco's first settlement house in 1890, providing health care, daycare, and education for immigrant families living in overcrowded, unsanitary conditions. Their work remains foundational to this day, and Telhi, the community center they founded, is just a few blocks from my home in San Francisco. Lily Hitchcock Coit, born 1843, was an eccentric and fearless figure, smoking cigars and wearing trousers before it was socially acceptable, and dressing as a man to gamble in North Beach's male-only establishments. She fled San Francisco after a scandal at the Palace Hotel in 1903, resurfacing years later after cooling her jets in Paris for a while, in time for the hotel's 1909 post-fire reopening, where she took up rooms again. She was a well-known supporter of firefighters in the city, having been made an honorary member of Knickerbocker Engine Company No. 5 as a teenager. Her legacy and the design of Coit Tower, built in 1933, have become intertwined with the city's firefighting history, with the Art Deco-style tower resembling a fire hose nozzle, though not the design intention of its architects. Amedeo Pietro Giannini, who founded the Bank of Italy, later Bank of America, was instrumental in rebuilding San Francisco after the 1906 earthquake and fire. His radical idea? Lending money to working-class immigrants when no other banks would. Fun fact, my boys attended A.P. Giannini Middle School in San Francisco. Given that George wrote his manuscript the same year the U.S. Congress passed the 19th Amendment, of which George was not a fan, and that his exploits unfolded during the Industrial Revolution, the single greatest driver of women's economic and social mobility in history, I felt an imperative to surface the untold stories of women and indigenous people who shaped the American frontier. In fact, the timing felt rather urgent, as women's evanescent rights correlate with climate crisis and the depletion of the very resources that made them possible. Ellie's clients, fictional names, real cases, drawn directly from my own career. Fernanda Salinas represents the many undocumented women I assisted who fled unlivable conditions in Mexico and were separated from their children after a series of unfortunate events. Hansa's case. I really did discover the red pushpin photo and caption on my own. Like the real Hansa, many women fear pursuing justice even when the evidence is irrefutable, and often avoid mentioning key details, even to their own attorneys, when they are embarrassing. Also, like Hansa, my client didn't wear a bindi and therefore dismissed the photo as too stupid to be significant. Bita Masudi's case, also real. Aggression towards women often manifests subtly. While in her home country, Bita may have faced a brutal beating for an improperly donned hijab, in the U.S., her oppressor was a bit less menacing. Ellie's own struggles, her wrongful termination, her battle as a special needs mother, including all those Mind Institute trips, the ping-ponging feelings, passion for her children, and emergency dried bean extraction with tweezers. Her fight against a former employer who underestimated her. All my own. The timesheet gate scandal? Real. The crack about, this is the last of the pregnant women, right? And the email stating I couldn't toe the line with a special needs child? Real. I remember vividly because toe was misspelled as T-O-W. Lawyers. If it's not in Latin, we can't spell it. And if it is in Latin, it probably means something bad. In fact, every word and deed attributed to the fictionally named Hutton and Fetterer Law Firm and its characters is directly sourced from my career. My case, leading to EEOC guidelines and legislation on caregiver discrimination and landing the cover feature of the New York Times Magazine, also real. At the time, about a dozen years before the timeline represented here, caregiver discrimination was not yet a protected category. My battle, alongside others, helped push for change. The real Ruby Martinez at UC College of the Law, San Francisco, formerly UC Hastings, was the one who convinced me to stand up and fight at a time when I'd been knocked down and thought I'd better stay down. And yes, I taught at both the UC Law Schools where Ellie supervises law clinic students and was a student in the Workers' Rights Clinic myself during law school before becoming a volunteer supervising attorney for years. A personal connection to North Beach and the Coast Miwok. My Italian roots trace back to early San Francisco and North Beach. Ellie's flat in North Beach, based on a real 5-unit building on Greenwich Street, designed by Paul DeMartini, built by Julius Martinelli, and commissioned by Albert Petzi in 1913. As of the completion of this manuscript, it's still owned by the Petzi family. In 1994, I volunteered at Olympali State Park in Marin County, California, braiding tule reed for the construction of new huts called cochas for a replica Miwok village. The park's neglect and erasure of Miwok history when I returned in 2024 for this novel, also real. The myth of indigenous extinction is dangerous. The Coast Miwok still exist. As Coast Miwok and UC Berkeley professor Peter Nelson puts it, portraying us as broken, divorced, and relocated from our history and knowledge is harmful. Our allies, co-conspirators, and accomplices must join us in celebrating the empowerment, health, and well-being of our communities. A whisper from the past. One day, while sorting through my family's artifacts, I found a carefully swaddled, monogrammed hat pin. It belonged to my great-great-grandmother. Holding it, I felt as though she were whispering to me across a century, her voice a flickering campfire keeping a story ablaze. This novel is my answer to her. And finally, about Mrs. O'Leary's cow. No, it did not start the Great Chicago Fire, but anti-Irish immigrant sentiment made sure Catherine O'Leary took the blame. Not her husband, Patrick, despite how uncommon it was at the time for a woman to own her own property or chattel. Besides, as Teddy aptly noted, who milks a cow at 9 o'clock p.m., which is when the fire broke out? The fire started near their barn, but meteorological data suggests a meteor shower and wind patterns carrying embers across Lake Michigan to the dry conditions in Chicago were the true cause. Growing up in a small town outside of Chicago, Mrs. O'Leary's cow was what we were taught in school. Not until 1997 was the O'Leary name cleared, though the cow was exonerated 11 years earlier in 1986. No joke. At any rate, the fire left George Ellis broke and in debt to PB about $3,000. So we women were nothing but trouble when all was said and done. And since the story wouldn't be complete without blaming a woman for the downfall of civilization, that tracks. As Jane Goodall put it, it actually doesn't take much to be considered a difficult woman. That's why there are so many of us.
Sam Francisco, open up your gates. Hurry, hurry, Sam Francisco, please don't make us wait. Hurry, hurry, go on and stock your fare. The whole world will be there. Send out your invitation.